This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Don't forget to stick around to the end of the episode to get the latest news around the Chicago area. But first, award shows are meant to be an escape, a few hours of glitz and glamour to honor excellent artistry and the people who move culture forward. But at this year's British Academy Film Awards, the spotlight shifted in the blink of an eye. As Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo presented an award on stage, the audience and viewers heard fellow presenter John Davidson, who has Tourette's syndrome, shout the N-word.
The BAFTAs were a night of celebration turned to controversy as the broadcast received criticism when the BBC aired a racial slur.
The failure is on BBC and BAFTA for not clipping this out when it was tape delayed by 2 hours in the UK.
The debate rages on over Bad Bunny's halftime show.
This is supposed to be a unifying event for the country, not for the Latinos.
Outrage follows a racist video posted by President Trump on True Social.
It featured racist imagery of former President Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle, depicting them as apes.
The BAFTA moment's been tied to a rare symptom known as coprolalia, the involuntary outburst of obscene or inappropriate words. And this comes just a couple of weeks after President Trump shared a racist video on social media of the Obamas as apes. Here with me in studio is In the Loop senior producer Sienna Greaves. Now, Sienna produced this conversation. Hey, Sienna.
Hey, Sasha. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. This was a tough one.
Yeah.
I got to admit, it was a tough one, but it was a topic that you knew you just had to pitch for our show. Why?
Right. It just keeps happening. It's been a crazy 2026.
Yeah.
And it feels like transgression after transgression. There is anti-Black, anti-POC energy,
mm-hmm.
not just in this country, almost, you know, globally, throughout the West, at least, I'll say, that doesn't seem to be diminishing in any way. And if anything, it keeps ramping up. And the BAFTAs, for me, was kind of my final straw, my 13th reason, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It is permeated film, television. You can't turn on TV. You can't watch sports. Every time there's, you know, something happening in the White House, there is this tinge of, like, racial animus.
Yeah.
And it needs to be talked about. And our ability to hold space for two things and say, yes, this is a disability issue, but there are victims here.
Yeah. With a platform like ours, it felt to me, you know,
it felt necessary.
Once you pitched that, I said, oh, we absolutely
it felt necessary
have to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you bring up something interesting there, the two parts to this. The use of deeply offensive racial slurs and tropes rooted in the history of slavery and racism against Black people in the U.S., that's one issue. But what followed were apologies that many people found lacking, or there was just no apology at all. So on this podcast episode, we're going to discuss the aftermath of the BAFTAs. And though it's important, we're not unpacking the disability angle of the story. Instead, our particular focus is on what Sienna just mentioned, the impact of these racist moments and memes, and why Black audiences are just continually asked to absorb the harm felt with grace. At the table was Pilar O'Dane, Associate Director of Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Greater Chicago, Brandon Pope, who's President of the Chicago Chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, and Danielle Robinson Bell, who's Associate Professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. What a Black History Month this has been. Can we start there?
We could. It's been a doozy.
It's still February. Shortest month of the year, but my goodness.
Yeah, one of the most cringeworthy ones I can remember.
So many transgressions. Yeah. How are you processing, Professor Bell?
You know, it's been interesting. When I woke up on Monday morning, I sat straight up in the bed because London being several hours ahead of us, and so all the headlines were flooding my phone about what happened at the BAFTA movement, and I bolted to my computer because I thought, here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go. What struck me most about that was the image of Michael B. Jordan and Daryl Lindo, because I said to myself, it's happening again, and it keeps happening. The poise at which they stood in that moment, I don't know if they were processing it, they heard it the way we heard it, but I just went, this happens so often.
That little pause that Delroy Lindo makes before he continues with the next line, I watch that over and over again.
Because you've been there.
Yes.
You're familiar with it. We're all familiar with it. How many times have we been in front of a colleague, a coworker, or a boss, you know, on the other end of something harmful like that, and we have that moment.
Mm-hmm. Pilar, what went through your mind initially?
SNCC. Took me right back to a time where we had strategy and where we had responses to these types of events, and they weren't able to penetrate us in the way that it's penetrating us now, because we had one another. We were together and mobilized in our own communities. And when we would see that, we knew who to call, who would address that immediately. We had scripts. We gathered the children. We, you know, sat at our tables and kitchens. The first thing I thought was, who's gathering? How do we, what do we do? Mm-hmm. What do we say? How do we address this? What do we tell our children who are Black? You know, Margaret Burroughs. I went there, and I was overcome with a profound sadness, and I actually shut the TV and the internet off to strategize. That's where I went.
Mm-hmm. Brandon?
Yeah, it was disheartening. I really felt bad for Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo, two actors who have worked so hard. We've watched their journey. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be a moment of pride for them.
And, before I saw an Instagram story breaking down Michael B. Jordan's tux.
Yeah.
Because it was like a fabulous, fabulous suit, top designer.
Yeah.
And then you're reduced to this moment.
This moment now takes away all of that, right? And I just, like you mentioned, we've been there before where you have to take the high road. Your feelings cast aside, you have to be the one that has to carry yourself with decorum and not react and have grace and understanding. But where is the grace and understanding for us?
Yeah.
And for those people who don't deserve that in their proudest moments, especially Delroy Lindo. Broke my heart to see his face.
I mean, 100%.
This is the ultimate pinnacle of his career. This man's been grinding for decades.
I was heartbroken.
And he's British.
That's right. In his homeland.
And front row, you got to hear that. It's tough.
I mean, and all of you here at the table with me have written about this on social. I've been seeing your posts on Threads and on LinkedIn, et cetera. Professor Bell, the BAFTA host said, you know, we apologize. This is in part, we apologize if you are offended. The BBC apologized for, quote, strong and offensive language. John Davidson said he was, quote, deeply mortified that people think that his involuntary tics are intentional. How important are apologies, and what would have been the appropriate apology? What would that look or sound like in a case like this?
I said this on LinkedIn, and I say it in my classes, and I'll say it again here. An apology is not accountability.
Exactly.
And it's not action. And everything that was said, the apologies from all the folks that you mentioned, Sasha Ann, felt like we were explaining away what actually happened. More than one thing can be true at the same time. And this was an opportunity for the folks involved, and I'm going to be specific in saying BAFTA and BBC.
Yes.
To not just acknowledge, and by the way, the word if you are offended. But
I'm sorry if you were hurt.
Which is the total wrong way to apologize.
That's
the
total wrong way.
You said it's not.
That was? Yeah.
That's a disclaimer.
No. It's a disclaimer. Yeah. What I would rather have seen happen, or what I hope the lesson from this is that we can hold space for things that were unintentional, involuntary, accident. We're all, if we're not parents, we've been around children and we know things happen.
Right.
Which is also why this is surprising, because we've been here before in our personal lives as children and as parents. We know accidents happen. At the same time, we can look to those who were harmed and say to their face, not just, I'm sorry, but are you okay and how?
Yeah.
Can we help here?
Exactly.
So everyone's on the same page, Pilar. Why does the N-word still cause so much harm?
Oh, that is a loaded question. It continues to cause so much harm. Number one, because it shouldn't be said. Number one. Period. It's extremely disrespectful. And our communities are torn about its purpose and its use. There are many who have decided to take this word and acculturate it into our everyday language and use it as a term of endearment, which continues to be to the chagrin of so many of us who still feel the trauma that this word, the disrespect that this word speaks to us as a people.
Yeah.
We need to lean more into the young people, because I believe that the young people have a serious role to play in how this word is used and perpetuated within our communities. And so I want to just say really quickly, I want to speak to the elders to not shy away from the young people, from the music, from the ways in which this word is perpetuated in our pop culture, but to lean in and remind us of the harms of this work, that this word has caused.
Yeah. Brandon, here's the thing. There was a 2-hour program delay.
Yeah.
There was a 2-hour delay. This part of the program could have been cut from the broadcast, and it wasn't. Even as other parts that were deemed offensive of the program that night were cut, this was not. That was a choice.
Yeah, including an actor that said Free Palestine. That was edited out.
Oh, you didn't know that. Yeah.
No.
That's right.
And
that
also
was completely removed.
Other offensive words that were blurted out were cut out. But for some reason, The Guardian spoke with some BBC producers who were like in the live truck as this is happening. They claimed they didn't hear it.
They said they couldn't hear
it. They couldn't hear it. They didn't catch it. Which is another problem in itself that word, do you hear it so cavalierly that you're just kind of like, eh?
Yeah.
You know, that's a problem in itself. What we're really speaking to here is the fact that the intent doesn't matter here as much as the impact, right? We all can understand that this man did not intend to cause harm. And it seems like everyone's reaction, the BAFTA's reaction, BBC, their apologies, are focused on the intent and not exactly the impact and harm that was caused. Not just to Delroy and Michael B. Jordan and that producer for Sinners that was also, you know, faced some of this, and then, but also us who had to hear it.
Yeah.
You know, everyone that had to listen.
Right.
This is a long problem, not just for BBC and the BAFTAs, but the industry itself when it comes to how we reckon with race and culture within the industry. And it once again reinforces that feeling that black people and people of color in general are just supposed to be happy they're there and not actively be truly appreciated and a part of these moments. And that's just not right.
I think what else is at play here is people's comfort.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so,
and whose comfort matters most?
Whose comfort matters most? A lot of executives, people who make these decisions, just aren't willing to be uncomfortable for the sake of someone else's comfort.
That's right.
And if we can just reckon with that for a little bit. we might get a little further along.
And all four of us here have had to deal with uncomfortability, sometimes daily.
All the time. Daily.
All the time.
That's
why we're here.
I mean, I post something on Twitter. I hear stuff back.
Pitching exactly. to talk about this conversation on In the Loop. That was a little uncomfortable. So as I teased at the top, I mean, we're seeing this come from all over the place, right? Our president puts out a meme on social media with you see Barack and Michelle Obama's heads on apes. And that circulates online for a while. Last night, the president has his State of the Union address. Representative Al Green is thrown out, holding a sign talking about the fact that black people are not apes. And it's not just the media where we're seeing this. It's coming from the White House, too, mm-hmm. Professor Bell. Talk about the psychological and emotional toll here. It's firing from all cylinders.
It's important to understand that just like trust is built mm-hmm. over time, just like respect builds over time when you think about relationship, so does harm. Mm-hmm. Harm is cumulative. Trauma mm-hmm. is cumulative. And that's where I think we are with this moment. Is the hits keep coming.
How do you protect your peace and stay informed?
I think that looks different for everybody. But what I like to remind people, my students especially, is you can do both. There's so many ways to stay informed without being on the front lines of all that's out there. Mm-hmm. And the way that you protect your peace, it doesn't have to be in these grandiose ways. You don't have to take a trip to the Maldives to protect your peace. We were talking about, things like meditation mm-hmm. and yoga. Mm-hmm. I tell my students, find your center. Mm-hmm. Tighten your core, to use a physical activity analysis, right? Analogy. Yeah. Tighten your core. Find your center, whatever that is to you, and stay there mm-hmm. for as long as you need to.
Yeah, weigh in, Pilar. I mean, how are you telling your clients to deal with this?
Yes, definitely. Self-care. It's a cliche. I feel sometimes that it's become so cliche. But to truly tap into the ways of our ancestors, and I'll say this a lot because I'm a big historian, I pull on the ways that we survived and that we were able to thrive, and to take time every single day to process.
And you're not talking about self-care, like go get a manicure, go get a pedicure, spa day.
Going deep inside in the silence. And this is something that people, I'm that person they hate to see come in sometimes. They're like, oh my gosh, she's going to start talking about that meditation and sitting in the quiet. But it's so important.
Here she comes talking about healing again.
I'm telling you, but it is my soapbox, and I will sing it as long as I have breath in my lungs, because it is so important for us to, I'll just give you a quick example. We use dishwashers, but my grandmother planned her entire life washing her dishes. To this day, when I wash my dishes, I don't use a dishwasher. I light a candle, and I plan my entire week washing those dishes in silence, right? Before that Zoom call, right? And then I have a disciplined strategy where I'm aware of how much TV I take in, how much news, mm-hmm. and then I turn it off.
Yeah.
And then I sit and I process. So the next day at that board meeting, I'm the one with all the fresh ideas. Why? Because I've already processed.
Yeah. Brandon, what are we going to do about this social media? What are we going to do?
Well, if I was the czar of social media.
We got to get out of the echo chamber.
That's part of it.
But are we too siloed, though? And is social media keeping us...
Yeah, and I think that's caused a lot of issues beyond just this. We're definitely siloed. Mm. And I think the algorithms have changed so much to where I feel like, here's a great example. Last night I was watching State of the Union trying to get real-time updates, and I look up State of the Union, and all I'm getting is just like the most ridiculous, backward stuff. And I'm just like, oh, the algorithm is feeding me outrage. It's feeding me things to make me upset.
Yes.
So I think the answer is simply we just got to stop using them. You know, that's easier said than done, right? But the algorithms aren't changing. Mm-mm. It's not going to – us complaining about it's not going to do anything, and our lawmakers aren't doing anything about it either, no matter how many congressional hearings they have about it. Mm-hmm. What we can do as people is put the phones down and actually talk to each other.
Yes.
Have the realization that what we're seeing online is not ourselves and our true selves, that there are people behind the keyboards, and try to really focus on that part. That's really what happens the most. We lose sense of there's somebody else on the other side of that.
Yes.
And you know, I feel myself getting emotional as you're talking, and I didn't expect this. This is exhausting.
It is.
It's exhausting.
It's draining.
It is.
I'm so tired of talking about this.
Yeah.
Same. I'm so tired.
Same. I feel you.
I'm so tired.
We're with you.
I'm
tired. Yeah.
And what we said this morning, how do we get here again?
Yeah.
How?
Yeah. This is, we've been here before. Mm-hmm. When you think about the history of our country, I was just telling Pilar, I grew up in the South. My mother picked cotton.
Yes. Yes.
She's 76.
Yes.
Right?
We're not that far removed.
We're not that far removed.
Yeah.
And I feel it. Sasha Ann.
Jesse Jackson's gone.
Yes.
So who will carry the mantles?
Right. Yeah. Who are the new leaders?
Who are the new leaders, and how do we support them and unearth them?
But what if I can for just a second, take a bit of a page from what you were saying, Brandon, about social media, and Pilar, what you were saying about the importance of taking the time and the space and the meditation. Somewhere in that is what I call sense making. Mm-hmm. We don't do enough of that.
No.
For ourselves and as a community. We're very quick to run to social media.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say we're also very quick to run to the yoga class for some of us, right?
Yes.
But have you given yourself an opportunity to, you know, there's a, you know, I would say watch the State of the Union. As you could decide not to watch it, but if you were to watch it, right, hear it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I'm not saying to do that. I know that that can be hard. But put yourself in a position to hear the thing at face value and then make sense of it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Then
let's
call together or do it in a group of people. But let's come in community with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then maybe go out if we have something then to say.
Yes.
And the other side of sense making is sense giving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then by the time you get to your social media outlet or you're in the boardroom or you're, you know, giving your presentation or you're now talking to your children about it, you've made sense of it for yourself. And that doesn't have to be set in stone either. Give yourself the opportunity or the permission to have that be a very fluid activity.
And we'll leave it there. That sense of community, I'm feeling it right now in this room. Thank you all for being here. That's Danielle Robinson-Bell, who's an associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Brandon Pope was here, president of the Chicago chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists. And Pilar O'Dain, who's associate director of Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Greater Chicago. Thank you all.
Thank you.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in Humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time. It might hurt you. Hope you don't lose your mind.
All right, a Pullman train car parked in the background. The sweet, unmistakable sounds of Buddy Guy on the soundtrack and on screen. And yes, even a few nods to the outfit mob. The Oscar-nominated movie Sinners is packed with Chicago references and themes, but they're not always front and center. In fact, the city almost plays an unseen character. Next, we're talking with our panelists about their recent Sun-Times articles, and we're digging into how Chicago's history, culture, and grit help shape the film's story, even when the city's skyline is not in the shot. At the table, Brandon Pope, who is also a Chicago film critic, and he stuck around for this conversation. Chicago film critic Reginald Ponder and Natalie Moore, who's a Sun-Times columnist and senior lecturer at Northwestern's Medill School. We started off by talking about the fallout from the BAFTAs, because, yep, this group wanted in on that subject, too. Here's Reggie.
The fact that we always have to respond with grace is problematic. I just saw a piece where Michelle Obama was asked about going high, and she explained about what she meant going high. She didn't mean that you didn't have to have the outrage, that you didn't have the to be upset about it, but she felt that if we fight nasty with nasty, the world is just going to end up being a bad place. And it's just unfortunate that we're the folks that have to say, let's not be nasty.
Mm-hmm. Natalie?
Same, but I'll also add that I think that this is an opportunity to listen to Black folks in the disability community, because I think there are a lot of things that we don't understand about Tourette's. And so what I have been looking for are for people who are speech therapists who know that, or other, you know, the disability community has spoken out, but the Black disability community is who I have really been wanting to hear from, who have said, this is bad, but you really have to understand how this tick works. Mm-hmm. That said, there still should be acknowledgement and apologies. So that's what I'm trying to take a seat in understanding,
mm-hmm.
While also understanding that grace and harm and all those things are being done as well.
Yeah, and the tie-in here, of course, is that the two men on stage are stars from Sinners, right? Delroy Lindo and Michael B. Jordan. So let's talk about the movie, because it was fantastic. I've seen it. I don't know how many times you've seen it. I've seen it three times at this point. Brandon?
Three times. Many theaters, yeah.
And so many positives, right? I mean, it's among, you know, all of the award-winning films at this point. Golden Globes, it's got a record-breaking amount of Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
Wumi Misako won just recently for Best Supporting Actress at the BAFTAs.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite movies, moments from Sinners,
ooh,
Brandon?
The scene that's always going to stick with me is that soul-stirring Generations of Music scene. The juke joint is burning down, and you just have all these different decades of Black music combining together and being felt in that room. That was one of my favorite scenes in film, period. And I think the way that Ludwig Göransson and Ryan just were able to collaborate so much from the cinema lens and also the sonic lens for that, feeling that in the theater, that was special.
Yeah. Did I forget my spoiler alert at the top of this?
Oh, yeah, my bad.
We cannot promise that we are not going to talk about the movie.
Go on HBO Max and watch it.
So, Natalie, but before we jump into your recent piece for the Sun-Times, I mean, for those who have not seen Sinners, briefly sum up what it's about, if you can.
Right. How do you sum up a sweeping movie like this? You know, what I have called it is a Jim Crow era saga that is wrapped in blues. There are vampires, but it's not a vampire movie. I forgot the line that I wrote in the Sun-Times, but whatever line I wrote, I'm like, okay. My sister was like, oh, that's a very good description. So, you know, I think the music and the time period and, you know, the setting, Mississippi Delta, you know, it's about racism.
You said it's a Jim Crow era story of allegorical vampires wrapped in blues, sharecropping, and spirituality.
Yeah, that's what I said.
End quote. That's what you wrote, madam.
Well said.
I thought that hit on all the a lot of the themes that were taking place in the film.
Here's the other thing you write about, and it's in your headline. You talk about the new Negro swagger. Explain that.
When I was watching Sinners, Chicago jumps out as this character. But just from my own research and reporting and history, I thought New Negro and World War I. The New Negro movement is a coined term by scholar Elaine Locke, and most people associate it with the Harlem Renaissance, but that was just the cultural aspect. So in the 1920s, you had a generation of Black folks who had not been slaves, who had this self-determination that is coming out, and World War I was a piece of that. They have fought abroad for democracy. They come home, and there's no democracy for them because they're second-class citizens. And also during this time, you have the Great Migration. So you have Southerners who are leaving racial terror or wanting opportunity, and they're coming to destinations like Chicago, Southside.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit from the film.
So tell me about Chicago. I heard they ain't got Jim Crow up there. A black man can go where he wants. Boy, you can't be believing anything that you hear. Time to fill your head up with this make-believe. And me and your cousin, we gonna give it to you straight. Chicago ain't shit from Mississippi with tall buildings and state of plantation.
Yeah, it's hard to miss the Chicago references in the film, isn't it, Brandon?
Very hard, but they're appreciated for sure. And I've heard that line kind of echoed amongst people I talk to about Chicago is just, you know, Mississippi with taller buildings in a sense, because I think there is this mentality that racism only exists in the South. And that's clearly not the case. It shows up differently in different parts of the country. And I think that line kind of spoke to that really well. Mm-hmm. And it's part of why this movie's resonated so well, because it goes deeper than just being a moment of time. It really crosses through other moments of time as well, with themes that really cross over across.
People are still talking about this film so much, or so long, I should say, after its actual release.
Yeah.
It's prompting so much conversation.
It's called impact right there.
Impact. I
mean, yeah.
We'll jump back to Natalie's story. But Reggie, I want to get you in here because you did something really cool. I'm jealous. You talked with director Ryan Coogler in L.A. What did he have to say to you about the links to Chicago?
The biggest thing is that Buddy had to be in it, is that a lot of people think that Buddy is a cameo in this whole piece, but actually Buddy is the linchpin, is that when you look at the spiritual aspect that Womney's character shows in the film, mm-hmm. he's that spiritual connection from beginning to end, even though you only see him in one scene. So Ryan talked about how his uncle loved Buddy Guy, and that Buddy Guy was pivotal in the whole blues, and that he came to Chicago, saw him, and said, "Hey, buddy, can you be in the movie?" And that was really what
it was. That simple. Wow.
It actually wasn't that simple. What actually happened was that his buddy's children told him he had to be in the movie, because Buddy was like, "I'm not an actor. I don't really want to be in the movie." But Buddy said that if my kids are telling me I need to listen to Ryan and be in your movie, okay, then let's do this.
Then let's do this. You make direct links, Natalie, to between the Smokestack Twins and notable Chicagoans. Tell us a bit more.
So I was imagining, so in the movie, it's twins played by Michael B. Jordan, and they had spent 7 years in Chicago. So the movie takes place in 1932. You see them and you immediately view the swagger, the suits, the wads of money,
mm-hmm.
And they're veterans, and they talk about being a soldier, and they know how to use weaponry. So I was imagining what they would have been doing in Chicago in the 1920s. So there were lots of clubs playing blues and jazz. I imagine, did they meet Jesse Binga, the first black banker, whose bank was across the street from one of the clubs? Did they cross paths with Anthony Overton, the cosmetics magnate? Were they reading the Chicago Defender, which was the most important black newspaper at the time, you know, I name checked different clubs that were going on. Were they on the stroll? Their mob outfit references.
Yeah.
You know, this is before the Policy Kings were really as influential as they were in Chicago that came in the 30s. You know, it's intimated that they were hustling the Italian mob and the Irish mob, and they had to come back to Mississippi to escape. But this is also during Prohibition, so they were probably bootleggers. But they would have also been in contact with an emerging class of African-Americans who were, you know, doctors and social workers. They wouldn't have been here during the 1919 riots, but during that time, you had veterans who were defending their neighborhoods with weapons from white rioters. So, you know, it was segregation. You know, they were relegated to the Black Belt, but you had blues. You also had Thomas Dorsey, the father of gospel music, who had been a blues player, which is why blues and gospel have so many chords similar to each other.
Right.
Did they cross paths with him? Did they go to rent parties? Did they go to Mount Olivet Church?
Yes.
So there are so all many, these things that they would have. I mean, I'm using my imagination.
Right.
Now, that said, this is where they would have had to have lived.
And as you brought up before, I mean, this is a horror film, right? It's violent. A lot of what's happening mirrors the real life horrors of racial violence at that time. Some might argue today. Sammy, the main character, Reggie, is transformed by the violence, right? And we see the way that music tells that story. Talk a bit more about how music is used in the film and what you heard from Buddy Guy's bandmate Orlando Wright.
One of the things that Orlando said, and it was very poignant, he just said that Buddy Guy is the Miles Davis of the blues. That statement in and of itself is heavy.
Yeah.
It's saying the impact that Buddy has on the music is unbelievable, and we still see that impact today. Buddy just won a Grammy. He just won a Grammy for—
At what, 89 years
old? At 89 years old. And the name of the album is I Ain't Through With the Blues. I Ain't Done With the Blues, I think it is. And he's not done. So what Ludwig did, and Brandon spoke about this a little bit, what Ludwig did with Buddy Guy and Raphael Sadiq and how they really studied and got deep into that music was unbelievable. I got a chance to speak with Lola Kirk, the music from that type of music as well.
Yeah.
All the music they were able to integrate. I know that Brandon says that his best scene, his favorite scene was that scene where you see all the different styles.
Like the mashup?
Well, I had two, and I hopefully get them in real quick. The one is with Womney and Michael B. Jordan when they're talking about their baby and having that discussion. And then that love scene that they end up having, it's an unbelievable scene for the type of woman that we allowed to have
it
that
was
scene.
Powerful. Mm. Yeah.
And then the other is Delroy Lindo in the car when he is talking. Delroy Lindo is a national treasure. He should have gotten nominated. I'm glad he got nominated.
Yes.
And the music is still all around that. And so when you look at my piece, you'll see in every facet, everybody talks about the music and how Buddy Guy was important and the blues was important to that whole
thing. Such a connective tissue throughout your article. Real quick, Brandon, Sinners, as we said, it's nominated for 16 Oscars, a record.
Yeah.
Which one would you like to see the film win?
Well, let's hope that all the 16? Nominations
Director.
Are not the prize itself, right? I think I'd like him to win it all, but I really think it's going to clean up with the original screenplay.
Yeah.
I want Delroy Lindo to win that Best Supporting Actor.
After the week he's had, the man deserves
he
it.
He deserves it.
We'll
absolutely.
Leave it there. Brandon Pope and Reggie Ponder are Chicago film critics, and Natalie Moore is a Sun-Times columnist and senior lecturer at Northwestern's Medill School. Now let's turn to the big news of the day. At the table to break down the biggest headlines and stories was Lisa Lavis, a WBEZ anchor, Mitchell Armantrout, a Chicago Sun-Times reporter, and Dave McKinney, who's a WBEZ politics editor, joined us remotely. Donald Trump gave the presidential State of the Union address during prime time last night. So Dave kicked things off with the main takeaways.
I did watch all whatever 109 minutes, 110 minutes, whatever it was. Of course, it was the longest State of the Union speech on record, which is sort of fitting with Trump's brand, is always wanting the biggest and best and things like that. I think his message, you know, he talked about the golden era is upon us, and he tried to, you know, what was occurring to me as we saw this parade of people that he kept pointing to in the gallery, and highlighting and giving, you know, various military or presidential medals to, it had like a game show quality to it. And I heard Abby Phillip make that comparison last night and saw it again in the Atlantic this morning. But I was thinking the same thing last night on the air. It's like, you know, and now our next guest, come on down. Mm. And I, you know, we had people like Erica Kirk and folks like that up there, but missing from all of this, I think, was a thorough kind of assessment of, you know, where are we at right now with grocery prices? Where are we at right now with this military buildup? That's surrounding Iran. What is the justification for potential military use there? Things like that, the details were missing. But in terms of pure showmanship, it was classic Trump.
Yeah. So was there a message?
Well, I mean, was there a message? I mean, I think he wanted to kind of give this. What came across, I think, to this national audience, and again, we don't know yet. Nielsen hasn't come out with their numbers yet this morning on how many people actually watch this. But I mean, the message I think he wanted to convey was that, you know, a year in office in the second term of his has been nothing but pure success. Americans are regaling in everything from, you know, cheaper egg prices and cheaper gasoline prices, allegedly, to respect around the world. That's the image that Donald Trump wants to convey. Now, you talk to focus groups, you look at the polls. A lot of Americans hold a very, very different view of America than that right now.
Yeah, Mitch, some Illinois representatives, they showed up and some chose to boycott. Just remind us what our reps from Illinois chose to do.
Right. Every year whenever there is a State of the Union address, it's an opportunity for folks in the other party to make their own political statements with their attendance or non-attendance and the guests that they bring along. Mm-hmm. Chuy Garcia brought along Mariamar Martinez, who is the woman who was shot by federal agents last summer during Midway Blitz. And she's really put herself out there over the last few months after being cleared of any wrongdoing in that case as an activist against President Trump's enhanced deportation effort. So obviously a very stark choice for Chuy Garcia to bring along. And U.S. Rep. Raja Krishnamoorthy, who's also running for Senate this time around.
Who walked out mid-speech?
That was Lauren Underwood, West Suburban U.S. Representative, who decided to stand up in the middle of the speech and walk out, kind of nodded at some of her fellow members of the Democratic delegation from Illinois on her way out. There were several other folks from the delegation just decided not to show up at all. They said it was just kind of another opportunity for Trump to cast out lies and propaganda in their view. It's from a Democratic delegation, that's pretty much what you would expect from Illinois.
Right. Lisa, Illinois leaders were live tweeting their reactions. Yeah. Governor Pritzker, Lieutenant Governor Stratton, tell us more.
Right. So Pritzker first tweeting, after spending the last year wreaking havoc on American communities, Donald Trump once again spewed lies, attempted to gaslight the American people, saying, "We endured 2 hours of baseless claims, shameless propaganda, and the ramblings of a wannabe dictator." Juliana Stratton, Lieutenant Governor, posting on X, "Great, why don't you start with the more than $8 billion," she gave the whole figure, "you've stolen from Illinois families with your illegal tariffs." And Senator Dick Durbin saying, "If grandstanding paid for groceries, the president would have ridden to the American people's rescue tonight. But it doesn't work that way. Instead, the president delivered empty platitudes about the success of his first year back in office."
Oh,
so
boy.
Everyone getting a little spicy there on Twitter.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the president himself in his speech last night.
"I used these tariffs, took in hundreds of billions of dollars to make great deals for our country, both economically and on a national security basis. Everything was working well. Countries that were ripping us off for decades are now paying us hundreds of billions of dollars. They were ripping us so badly, you all know that. Everybody knows it. Even the Democrats know it. They just don't want to say it."
Oh, boy. All right, Mitch, we are less than 3 weeks away from the Illinois primary. Lots of races to watch. I know that you have your eye on the governor's race in particular. How is that shaping up so far?
The governor's race? So this is just a matchup to see who gets to go against J.B. Pritzker, who is not facing a primary opponent this time around. And on the Republican side, a lot of familiar faces we've seen before. Darren Bailey is running it back. He, of course, was the general election nominee last time around in 2022. Mm-hmm. He lost mightily to J.B. Pritzker last time around, but he's back this time really trying to project more of a little bit of a softer image. You know, his campaign in 2022 is really focused on a lot of social issues. He's against abortion rights, very much pro-gun rights, things that are really not necessarily within reach or of, you know, affecting in the governor's office. And that's something that he's really trying to highlight this time around. He's facing businessman Rick Heidner, who's really made his fortune on a gas station and video gambling.
I've been seeing his commercials a lot.
Right. He's pumped. It's a self-funded candidate who is putting a lot of money behind his campaign, obviously, here. And then we've also got conservative commentator Ted Dabrowski, who's a pretty well-known figure in political circles, really a fact and numbers-based, sort of a just the number cruncher,
yeah.
Kind of putting himself out there in front of the camera lens this time. And then rounding out the race is James Mendrick, who is the DuPage County Sheriff, who, again, all these folks are trying to portray Pritzker as someone who's raised taxes in Illinois and raised the cost of living. And that's obviously something that J.B. Pritzker would not agree with.
Yeah, Dave, weigh in here. I mean, talk about where you see them differing, these opponents, and where do they see the governor's vulnerabilities?
Well, on the vulnerability question, I mean, you can see it kind of this common thread among all of them that they believe, you know, prices and taxes and affordability in Illinois are just out of reach for most Illinoisans. So they many of them are hitting on this message. They talk about crime. But you know, even though crime, we've seen data showing that violent crime in Illinois has been, as it is across the country, in decline. So, I mean, it's a message that's a bit, you know, at least on that side of it, a little hard to kind of reconcile with what we're seeing on the ground. But, you know, where do these guys differ? Well, I mean, you know, just at a base level, they differ geographically, of course, where they come from. I mean, Bailey, the guy that, you know, lost to Pritzker 4 years ago, mm-hmm. is the only downstater in the mix. And the other three all have, you know, suburban ties. And that's really the Republican Party kind of relinquished control 20 or 30 years ago, where they once were like this brand that won every suburban election. And then Democrats stepped in and pretty much consistently have won most major elections in the collar counties. For the Republicans to succeed, especially in a race against a billionaire governor who's well established, who has, you know, avoided the taint of, you know, other governors in our past, you know, with scandals or criminal investigations, they face an uphill battle just in getting their messages out, getting resources to put into a campaign. And so I think that's, you know, that's the uphill struggle they have. And in terms of their differences, I think that they are all still, you know, kind of in lockstep on a lot of the major themes. I mean, you know, no one is out there really, you know, hitting Trump hard, even though Trump is,
right,
is an unpopular commodity in Illinois. So, I mean, there's more similarities than differences, I would say.
Yeah, so much to follow with this upcoming primary. But switching gears, Lisa, we have an update here on Reverend Jesse Jackson. What details can you share about
right.
the services?
Yeah, Sasha, so there was a small service, a gathering over the weekend at Rainbow Push, and now services are coming together. So the schedule includes that the Reverend Jackson's body will lie in repose at Rainbow Push starting tomorrow mm-hmm. at 10 a.m., also Friday, so the public can come and pay their respects. So that's Thursday, Friday. And then his body will be transported to South Carolina. That's where he was born, in Greenville, South Carolina. That's where he started his political activism when he was a teenager, trying
that's
to
right.
integrate a public library. And then, so that's Monday. There'll be some formal services in South Carolina on Monday. And then Wednesday, there will be a formal service. The Reverend's body will be transported to Washington, D.C. for a formal service on Wednesday. And then back here in Chicago for what they're calling a homecoming service, the people's celebration, actually, on Friday, March 6th at the House of Hope on the South Side. Now, lots of dignitaries invited. We don't know who's going to come, but President Trump plus all the ex-presidents, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton.
It sounds like plenty of chance for Chicagoans to pay their respects.
It is definitely going to be a very big and important event, you know, so, you know, we'll keep an eye on it.
Yeah. In other news, WGN-TV laid off a number of people both in front and behind the camera. Just seems like the story that you know, we keep hearing here in this industry. We now know more about who got axed. I mean, Lisa.
Sure.
And I want to hear from all of you because this touches us all, right?
Names you probably know if you watch WGN Channel 9 at all. I think most notably Dean Richards, their entertainment reporter who has been around for a very long time. Well-known, well-liked, you know, that was a big surprise to me. You've also got Julian Cruz, Sean Lewis, Judy Wang. These are people who you know, you get to know. Brenna Tumulty also out of there. And Sean Lewis told the Tribune staff, said that they were told that it was budgetary, but it's because of this Nexstar merger. Nexstar trying to buy a merger company called Tegna.
And that's what happens when these mergers happen behind the scenes. Mitch, any thoughts?
I can just say that Sean Lewis, Julian Cruz, Brana, just interacting with them out covering events, really just truly professionals, really wonderful people. And this is it's a tough time it's a tough time in a lot of industries. It's been a tough time in the media industry for decades, it feels like, and my heart goes out to them.
Yeah, Dave.
Well, I would say the same thing as Mitch. I mean, I covered last year the Madigan trial, and Julian Cruz was there every single day. I mean, if you just focus in on a guy like Cruz, I mean, he of course was a general assignment reporter, which meant he was a jack of all trades. He knew how to cover fires and bank robberies and tornadoes and murders. But he also had an ability to go into the Chicago Federal Courthouse and know his way around. And when you lose kind of a seasoned reporter like that, it may not register much on people's consciousness. But the fact is, you lose that institutional knowledge of how our democracy, of how our system works, who its players are, and all the rules that exist. And that's a real shame here that we all kind of suffer when our information ecosystem takes a hit like this. We all become a little bit dumber as a result of it.
We'll leave it there. WBEZ's Dave McKinney and Lisa Labez and Mitchell Armantrout with the Chicago Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.